I checked with the almanac and knew that Saturn was high in the east after sunset. As soon as it was dark, I was up on the roof again with my crazy contraption of wood and glass propped between two chimneys. It was late fall, but I never noticed the cold, for the sky was full of stars, and they were all mine. I took my time setting the focus as accurately as possible using the first star that came into the field. Then I started hunting for Saturn, and soon discovered how hard it was to locate anything in a reflecting telescope that wasn't properly mounted. But presently the planet shot across the field of view. I nudged the instrument a few inches this way and that, and there it was. It was tiny, but it was perfect. I don't think I breathed for a minute. I could hardly believe my eyes. After all the pictures, here was the reality. It looked like a toy hanging there in space, with the rings slightly open and tilted toward me. Even now, 40 years later, I can remember thinking, it looks so artificial, like something from a Christmas tree. There was a single bright star to the left of it, and I knew that was Titan. He paused, and for a moment we must have shared the same thoughts. For to both of us, Titan was no longer merely the largest moon of Saturn, a point of light known only to astronomers. It was the fiercely hostile world upon which Endeavor had landed, and where three of my crewmates lay in lonely graves farther from their homes than any of mankind's dead had ever rested before. I don't know how long I stared, straining my eyes and moving the telescope across the sky in jerky steps as Saturn rose above the city. I was a billion miles from New York, but presently New York caught up with me. I told you about our hotel. It belonged to my mother, but my father ran it, not very well. It had been losing money for years, and all through my boyhood there had been continuous financial crises. So I don't want to blame my father for drinking. He must have been half crazy with worry most of the time. And I had quite forgotten that I was supposed to be helping the clerk at the reception desk. So Dad came looking for me, full of his own cares and knowing nothing about my dreams. He found me stargazing on the roof. He wasn't a cruel man. He couldn't have understood the study and patience and care that had gone into my little telescope or the wonders it had shown me during the short time I had used it. I don't hate him any more, but I'll remember all my life the splintering crack of my first and last mirror as it smashed against the brickwork. There was nothing I could say. My initial resentment at this interruption had long since changed to curiosity. Already I sensed that there was much more to this story than I'd heard so far, and I'd noticed something else. The waitress was treating us with an exaggerated deference, only a little of which was directed at me. My companion toyed with the sugar bowl while I waited in silent sympathy. By this time I felt there was some bond between us, though I did not know exactly what it was. "I never built another telescope," he said. "Something else broke, besides that mirror. Something in my heart. Anyway, I was much too busy. Two things happened that turned my life upside down. Dad walked out on us, leaving me the head of the family, and then they pulled down the Third Avenue L. He must have seen my puzzled look, for he grinned across the table at me. "Oh, you wouldn't know about that, but when I was a kid, there was an elevated railroad down the middle of Third. It made the whole area dirty and noisy. The avenue was a slum district of bars, pawn shops, and cheap hotels like ours. All that changed when the L went. Land values shot up, and we were suddenly prosperous. Dad came back quickly enough, but it was too late. I was running the business. Before long, I started moving across town, then across country. I wasn't an absent-minded stargazer anymore, and I gave Dad one of my smaller hotels where he couldn't do much harm. It's 40 years since I looked at Saturn, but I've never forgotten that one glimpse. And last night your photographs brought it all back. I just wanted to say how grateful I am." He fumbled in his wallet and pulled out a card. "I hope you'll look me up when you're in town again. You can be sure I'll be there if you give any more lectures. Good luck, and I'm sorry to have taken so much of your time." Then he was gone, almost before I could say a word. I glanced at the card, put it away in my pocket, and finished my breakfast rather thoughtfully. When I signed my check on the way out of the coffee shop, I asked, "Who was that gentleman at my table, the boss?" The cashier looked at me as if I were mentally retarded. "I suppose you could call him that, sir," she answered. "Of course, he owns this hotel, but we've never seen him here before. He always stays at the Ambassador when he's in Chicago." "And does he own that?" I said, without too much irony, for I'd already suspected the answer. "Why, yes, as well as," and she rattled off a whole string of others, including the two biggest hotels in New York. I was impressed, and also rather amused, for now it was obvious that Mr. Perlman had come here with the deliberate intention of meeting me. It seemed a roundabout way of doing it. I knew nothing then of his notorious shyness and secretiveness. From the first, he was never shy with me. Then I forgot about him for 5 years. Oh, I should mention that when I asked for my bill, I was told I didn't have one. During that 5 years, I made my second trip. We knew what to expect this time and weren't going completely into the unknown. There were no more worries about fuel because all we could ever use was waiting for us on Titan. We just had to pump its methane atmosphere into our tanks, and we'd made our plans accordingly. One after another, we visited all the 9 moons, and then we went into the rings. There was little danger, yet it was a nerve-wracking experience. The ring system is very thin, you know, only about 20 miles in thickness. We descended into it slowly and cautiously, after having matched its spin so that we were moving at exactly the same speed. It was like stepping onto a carousel, 170,000 miles across. But a ghostly kind of carousel, because the rings aren't solid, and you can look right through them. Close up, in fact, they're almost invisible. The billions of separate particles that make them up are so widely spaced that all you can see in your immediate neighborhood are occasional small chunks drifting very slowly past. It's only when you look into the distance that the countless fragments merge into a continuous sheet, like a hailstorm that sweeps around Saturn forever. That's not my phrase, but it's a good one. For when we brought our first piece of genuine Saturnian ring into the airlock, it melted down in a few minutes into a pool of muddy water. Some people think it spoils the magic to know that the rings, or 90% of them, are made of ordinary ice. But that's a stupid attitude. They would be just as wonderful and just as beautiful if they were made of diamond. When I got back to Earth in the first year of the new century, I started off on another lecture tour, only a short one, for now I had a family and wanted to see as much of it as possible. This time I ran into Mr. Perlman in New York when I was speaking at Columbia and showing our movie Exploring Saturn, a misleading title that, since the nearest we'd been to the planet itself was about 20,000 miles. No one dreamed in those days that men would ever go down into the turbulent slush, which is the closest thing Saturn has to a surface.